Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of June 13th. I'm John Gibson, and sitting with me in a now calm Tokyo after the earthquake is Jim Allen. How's it going, man?
It's good, and I'm ready to roll, earthquake or no.
And I'm ready to rock.
Okay.
All right, on this week's show, we've got an interview with DeNA skipper Alex Ramirez. We're going to talk about the Bay Stars, interleague play, Ichiro, and we have great listener questions, so let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
Okay, well, I had a chance to talk to Alex Ramirez a few days ago, and it seems funny to call him Manager Ramirez.
Skipper.
Yeah, it's like, wow. So, you know, we touched on a few subjects. You know, I was so curious about, you know, the way he communicated with the team, and I've been so impressed by some of the things I've seen. So, you know, I wanted to touch on those subjects, but, you know, you never have time. He gives you all the time he's got, and it's never enough.
I know, and he's very gracious. As a player, we were able to go up to him and talk to him anytime we wanted to, but now he's the skipper, and you have to go through the PR department. And I talked to a guy actually on the Wednesday before you talked to Alex, mm-hmm. and I basically buttered him up and said we wanted to have a little chat with him, and it wasn't going to take very long. And so by the time you got out there and mentioned my name, probably was a little bit easier to get the conversation.
Yeah, in fact, I mentioned John Gibson's name, and he said, "Hold on a second, hold it right there, buddy." And he pulled out the portable red carpet for me.
Oh, I thought you were going to say some kind of a firearm or something.
No. He said, "Any friend of Gibson's is a friend of Rick's. I mean, of mine."
Okay. Whatever.
Whatever, indeed. So, okay, no more Casablanca references for today's show.
Thank you.
Yes, okay. So, anyway, so many questions, but very graciously asked, and I think you're gonna learn some stuff here. And I certainly did about, you know, how he goes about managing, you know, because we started the podcast after the sort of golden era mm-hmm. of managers in Japan, when we had, you know, three or four. One year in 2007, we had four guys managing here. And we really miss that. So it's really good to, you know, have a manager on the show, go through the nuts and bolts of his process of learning the job. So let's have a listen.
Okay, our guest this week on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is Bay Stars manager Alex Ramirez. Thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you.
About the 20th time, maybe.
Keep it going.
Yeah, we've been here a while.
So. Yes, yes.
So, you know, you obviously, when you came to Japan as a, you know, major leaguer and you're thinking about your future career, this was probably not the first thing on your radar was to be a manager in Japan.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, when I first came here, I just wanted to come here for 1 year.
Yeah.
And, you know, make enough money and then go back to United States to AAA, to the minor leagues, and then live a good life.
Yeah.
You know, and never crossed my mind I was going to be here this long and even being a manager.
But then when I watch you given, you know, talking to the press before the game, you look like you're really in your element now.
Well, you know, I have more experience.
Okay.
You know, I prepare myself pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I really study. I'm taking it day by day, and I'm studying a lot about my players and stats and things like that. So when I talk to the media, I have more things that I can say. This is the way I want to go.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way I want to do things, because the stats is right. It's just facts.
Right.
I base everything on facts now,
okay.
And you know, it's I feel more comfortable doing it that way.
Yeah, it seems to me that you're one of the guys who actually managers who feels comfortable talking about his plans.
Yes, I do. You know, I got the support from my you know, actually from my boss,
mm-hmm.
and the GM is giving me a great support that I just, you know, go out there and do whatever you need to do to build this team, to change this team.
Okay.
And like I say, I have a study, you know, every day I'm studying a little bit, I'm learning and I'm preparing myself,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not afraid to tell people, you know, what my plans are, especially with my team.
Okay. One of the things that I wanted to ask you is because you, obviously, a player, you know, you go through ups and downs, and there's a lot of stress as a player on your performance and, you know, in life in general. But as a manager, you get different kinds of stress.
No? Oh, yes. Yes. It's way different.
Yeah.
You know, as a player, you are, you know, sometimes when you're not doing good, you're stressed. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a lot of stress, but you're only thinking about yourself.
Right.
You know, as a manager, you have to think about everybody.
Right.
And all the stress from the hitters, from the pitchers, it becomes your stress.
Right.
And so it's a little bit different. So, you know, that's one thing that I always say, you have to know your players and for you to be able to learn about the league.
Okay.
You know, because that's the only way you're going to be able to compete. And those stress, it can only make you better.
Okay.
If you think positive way.
Okay. Well, I know you're always a positive guy and everything's, you know, always looking for the bright side of everything, but obviously some of the stress as a manager probably took you by surprise.
Mm. Well, yes. I mean, you know, sometimes it's different than what I expected.
Uh-huh.
You know, so many things that I always said that I felt that it was going to be different.
Uh-huh.
When I became a manager, I realized, well, I cannot do these things. I cannot do these things. I cannot do these things. So it became very stressful at the beginning.
Okay.
But, I have to find a way to fix these things or to adjust to these things, you know. So, you know, those things are, you know, of course, you know, we're learning day by day.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always something different than what I expected.
Right.
You know, and as being my first year as a manager, you know, I've only been a manager for a couple of months now.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, every day you go through, you know, one thing that you, oh, okay, I understand, you know, no problem.
Right.
I was thinking different way, but now I understand. So, yeah, okay.
I see now a couple of things. Now, remember, we talked in January about your focus on the batteries, you know, on the communication pitchers and catchers and the plan of attack. Now, did you foresee, you know, not walking anybody and having such an effective pitching staff?
Well, you know, I think that right from the beginning of the season, I felt that we had a really good pitching staff. But the key was going to be the catcher, to get somebody that it was going to be able to, you know, to take the lead and lead these pitching staff to be one of the best. And for us to be able to do that, of course, I had to do so many things, especially with the pitching staff. You know, we got to pitch to this guy. We got to walk this guy. We let's see how many pitches can this guy throw.
Right.
You know, so I had to study a lot, which it took me a little bit of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the beginning of the season, I struggled with those things.
Mm-hmm.
Because at some point, I took pitchers basically at the wrong time because
okay.
I felt I think this is the best time to take him out.
Mm-hmm.
But the pitcher's only throwing, you know, 70, 80 pitches.
Right.
And he was, you know, I didn't realize that this is his peak. This is his best timing.
Ah, okay.
You know, this guy can throw 120 pitches,
right.
You know, still have maintained the condition. So at the beginning of the season, it was very tough.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, now I feel a lot better. I know all my guys and, you know, trying to make better decisions.
Okay, now let me ask you, now, as a player, you know in Japan that the second half, you know, that's time for the hitters if you're ready, if you're fit.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the, you know, the pitches flatten out. And so you've probably got to be thinking, now, what are we going to do for the second half to keep this conditioning with the pitchers? Have you had any input into that with the conditioning staff?
Yes, actually, I have. I'm already preparing myself for that. You know, of course, you know, good hitters always start slow in the,
right.
in the second half of the season. They you know, they have a better idea and they produce better. At this point, we have eight pitchers, starting pitchers,
mm-hmm.
That we need to, you know, right now they're good. They're being consistent.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the beginning of the season, I've been using these guys for 8 innings, 7 innings, 8 innings, 100, 110, 120 pitches,
mm-hmm.
you know. But now my plan is to cut a little bit more on these guys,
right.
Throw less pitches, throw, you know, less innings, and use the bullpen a little bit more. Uh-huh. That way I can keep those guys healthy throughout the season,
okay.
And also rotate some of these guys.
Okay.
You know, so because it's, of course, it's not going to be easy second time of the season.
Right.
Now we have 4 young pitchers that are doing really good right now. But are they gonna continue doing like this the second half of the season? You know, how they're gonna react when the hitters start you know, taking those pitches and waiting for the good pitches. Mm-hmm. You know, so all those things, I have those things in mind, and I have a plan for that.
Okay. Another plan is this year I've noticed there's four teams in the Central League that have really decided we're going to bunt less. You, Hiroshima, Hanshin, and Yakult. Mm. Now, was that part of the plan from the camp? You said we're not going to bunt maybe as much as you're used to?
That was part of the plan, but, you know, I realized that sometimes we have to bunt early. You know, when we're facing number one pitcher, you cannot give him a chance. And sometimes you have to bunt early in the game to score, be able to score one run, and that run may make the difference. So, you know, those little things, you know, I'm considering all those little things. You know, sometimes there's teams that I don't have to bunt early in the game, but there's some teams that, you know, I need to bunt early in the game.
It depends more on the pitcher you're facing than on the pitcher who's pitching for you?
It all depends on the pitcher we're facing. You know, when we face Hiroshima Carp and we're facing Johnson, you know, we got to score one run ahead. Right. If they score early in the game, he becomes tougher. Okay. You know, it's kind of tough to beat him. You know, when we face Sugano, I mean, those guys are very tough. So we got to score early in the game. So if we have to bunt second hitter, you know, that's what we need to do. We're going to do.
Okay, the last question I want to ask you is, before the start of this, or I should say there was a lot of talk in the media about, you know, trying to go for the first strike, and I think it's not that simple. Mm. But you did have a focus on the guys going after the first hittable pitch.
My focus is to hit the first strike. You know, when you tell the guys, try to hit something, the first pitch, something in the strike zone, you know, some of these guys don't know what to do with that. You know, it's a little bit hard. It's better to just make a sample for them and say, be ready for the first strike.
Okay.
You know, so it's, you know, as right now, as a team, we're hitting over 3.7 and hitting first pitch. For first strike. Mm-hmm. So the team is doing really good. So it's working.
Is that that's not an easy process if you're taking trying to input a new approach when this is the way I hit.
Yes, yes. And, sometimes you have to show results.
Yeah.
And at the beginning of the season, we were struggling. We were hitting, you know, 240, 250. But, you know, after we start changing that approach and then we start telling our hitters we have to hit early in the count. We have to hit first strike. We have to hit and reminding all the guys. And then we became better, and then they start seeing better results.
Okay.
And now the numbers don't lie. You know, the numbers are there. The team is doing really good at hitting the first strike, and, you know, we want to continue.
Well, I want to thank you again for your time, and good luck.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Alex. Much appreciated, man. Great. You know, it's always great to catch up with you and hear your, I think, you know, just straight talk.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. Thank you very much, Alex. It's good to hear you always.
Now, what would you like to comment on that we can fit into, you know, fit into the bounds of a podcast?
Right. I would love to comment on everything, but I'm just going to pick out the big things that were impactful for me. And I guess the biggest thing was the part about the pitching in which he said, because I often wondered about this as these guys take over as managers, and obviously they're former position players. We have a lot of catchers. We have a lot of pitchers. Here's an outfielder taking over a team, and when it comes to pitching, what are they going to do? And that's always the key for me in terms of whether it's a former pitcher or a former catcher or a position player. And in the case of Alex Ramirez, I thought when he said he struggled with the timing on the changing of pitchers, when to take them out, when to put new guys in, that was the thing that made me perk up. And I think we got to look at that on Saturday. When he talked about, obviously he struggled early on and he didn't know when to take out his starters, or, you know, you have this big major, you have this plan for a game. And on Saturday we had Shota Imanaga, the rookie, who threw six scoreless innings, and he was at 90 pitches and the team had a 5-0 lead, and he took the rookie out.
Mm.
And you might think, okay, well, isn't that a little bit early? The guy's right. Sailing along, he's got a shutout, why do you need to do that? But I think when you hear Alex talk about the entire season as a whole and trying to keep the guys healthy, trying to keep them fresh and make sure that they're effective late in the season, when you really need these to win some games, or you need them to be as effective as possible, and some guys are going to have to pitch on short rest, when you hear about the entire plan for the season, then you get a better perspective about that. And I think a lot of times, as fans, we want to see the team win every day.
We do.
We get upset when they lose. I've seen some guys on Twitter saying, well, you know, this team is better than that. It shouldn't have been swept by the Hawks. And I'm like, you know, there's no team out there that can say it shouldn't be swept by the Hawks. They're the best team in the game.
Accurate. Yes.
So, and you know, they can play better than this. Well, yes, certainly they can, but there's a plan in place that, and I said it before on the show that we're privy to the results, but we don't know what the plan is. And this gives you some insight as to what the plan is for the Bay Stars that they're looking to at the season as a whole. So while I agree you want to have a guy out there, it'd be very healthy for his confidence to have him go the distance and pitch a shutout and dominate a Pacific League team in interleague. Is that really the best thing for your team? And probably not. And so I really like that aspect. You know, I look at these guys and they're not robots. You know, the pitchers go out there, we expect them to do the same thing every game. That's not possible. We expect the same outcome. That's not possible.
Right.
And then whenever you look at Alex, whenever you take a pitcher out, it sends a message to the guy.
Sure.
There's a residual effect. It can be positive or negative. So when you take him out, maybe it says that I don't trust you so much. When you leave, when you leave the guy in, maybe it says I trust you. I believe in you. And putting a reliever in a certain situation, again, has a message to these guys. So I think every move that you make impacts future performance of the individual. So I don't think it's so easy. We always say, you know, from the stands or from our living rooms, or even if you're like me sometimes listening on the radio in the train and not even looking at the quality of the pitches and saying, and you're just hearing, okay, then you're just putting the numbers together. This guy's at 90 pitches. It's six innings. He hasn't done it. He hasn't given up that many hits. Why are you taking him out? It's very easy to make the decision, but you know, it's a very difficult situation. And also, you look at it this way, the starting pitchers, they basically, they work once a week in Japan. So they do rehab like work. You know, you got to get your innings in.
Maybe they need to be going to like Hello Work or something.
They need to be more what?
They need to go to Hello Work. Which is the name of the employment office in Japan.
Right.
Hello Work.
Yeah, because they're not doing anything. But I mean, you know, they're doing their running, they're doing their whatever their routine is during the week, and they only get to work once a week. So that's a big deal for them. That's a big day for them where they come in, they're expected to perform. They're looking to do well. And if you get pulled after five innings or six innings, you're mostly doing rehab for the whole season. So all rehab and no play makes Jack a frustrated boy, in my opinion. I think these guys want to pitch as much as they can. They want to leave it all out there in the field. And if you don't give them the opportunity, that makes it really difficult, in terms of, you know, the psyche of a player, I think.
I think it does, but I also think that, you know, it's all a question of what the player expects. Mm. You know, we saw Satoru Kanemura throw a temper tantrum in 2006 because
Trey Hillman,
he was pulled with two outs in the fifth inning. It was the fourth inning.
Yeah.
He was pulled an out shy of qualifying for the win. And the relief pitcher, you know, fixed that by giving up a three-run triple. But, he threw a temper tantrum because part of his expectation was that he would have a chance to win 10 games.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So a lot has to do with the expectation. If he had gone into that game knowing that if this is the situation, this is going to happen, well, then it's on him. And I think when you listen to Alex Ramirez, you get, you have to ask yourself, you know, he says, this is my plan. You know, we want it to be open. He's very transparent with that, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, how much do the players understand the plan, which we don't know? You know, how much do the coaches understand this plan? We don't know. My guess is pretty well.
I would imagine.
because he's very open about communicating. You know, he can't be telling this to the media, he could be telling one thing to the media and one thing to the team. That would be standard procedure in Japan.
Correct.
But generally, very often you get managers talking about things that the team doesn't know about. You know, as he's talking about ifs and maybes, but what I get is a remarkable, sense of, you know, this is a work in progress, but these are the things we've accomplished. These are the things we're working on now. you know, an orderly, a very orderly scientific approach to his first year in office, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that's actually something I talked about in the preseason. I said they're going to be really well prepared because Alex Ramirez as a player was always well prepared.
Yeah, and I was fascinated by the process of changing from when you're a player to prepare yourself to you're a manager, you know. How do you prepare the coaches to prepare the players? How, you know, what do you expect from the coaches? What do you expect from the players? We've seen guys who had no managing experiences, such as Ramirez, and no coaching experiences. He has a little going to be manager, and we've seen them do very, very well in Japan. And I'm thinking of Hiromitsu Ochiai because basically his philosophy was the players play the game, the coaches do their best to get them ready. And I have to, you know, let the coaches do their job. I have to let the players do their job. And I'm going to step in when I think I need to step in, which is probably less than I will. You know, I'm not going to be, hands on everything. The players have to learn to play. And one of the things that, one of the key things that manager Ramirez told me in January was, training the battery, the catcher, pitcher and the catcher to think on their feet, to work together, to talk to each other.
Right.
I spoke to him after a game a few weeks ago. I said, was it your team's game plan to change from this plan of attack to this plan of attack to another plan of attack as the starting pitcher, in that case was Ishida or Imanaga, I don't remember, went through the lineup each time, and he said, no, that was the pitcher and the catcher and the battery coach deciding that. That's not my, you know, that's not what I do.
Great. Yeah, that's good insight.
So interesting stuff, and I think the thing that I would like to count, I guess I'll go back to the scientific approach, because he starts with the assumption, oh, this is how it's going to work. Oh, it's not going to work like that. Okay, change the assumption. If it does work like that, okay, fine. We'll check that off the list for the time being. You know, it's just sort of like building these blocks, and I had this impression from the start when I saw that his pitchers weren't walking anybody. I thought, you know, walks are something you can, to some degree, really control. You can get the pitchers to throw strikes. You can get the pitchers to say, you know, this is going to be in the strike zone, you know, hit it if you can, and we're going to work on ways we can do that. And the Bay Stars have just excelled at not walking guys, which is what you have to do when you pitch in a park where home runs get out really easily.
Yeah, they just kind of float over the fence sometimes, the Oklahoma
team. Yeah, they do float out into the park sometimes. So yeah, so that's a huge thing, and I'm so impressed. Now the other thing which I was really curious about was the first strike bit, because I'm going, oh, it can't be as simple as it sounds, and he made it sound simpler. You know, I thought he was going to say, well, you know, with this hitter in this case and this hitter in this case, no, let's not make it more difficult. And I'm going, wow, that's interesting. Okay, now, and I thought, wow, oversimplification, great. I live a life against, you know, oversimplification. My life is based on, you know, it's not that easy. But one of the things I noticed when I looked up the data, he said that the Bay Stars, they were batting 370, hitting the first strike. Now, I looked at the data about 4 or 5 days later, and they were hitting 348, which was second best in the Central League.
Behind?
First strikes. Behind the Hanshin Tigers, who were hitting 370. It's almost like somebody gave them the wrong data, which is possible. No, that's us.
Well, it was 5 days later. Everything changed.
Ignore the part about where it says Hanshin. They had DNA written in crayon. Okay. Anyway, so that's good. And that's a good thing. Yes, they are good at it. And here's the thing. Now, if you're going after the first strike, you're going to have fewer three ball counts.
Okay.
Obviously, because you're not going to be, you know, you.
If you're putting it in play, certainly, yeah.
Exactly. Or putting it into play early, as Michael Westbay pointed out earlier in this year that they were. And so that's a bad thing, because all your offensive numbers go up when you're in three ball counts. But here's the opposite side of that opposite side, the other side of the other side, is that when the Bay Stars do
how many sides are we looking at here?
It's multifaceted, okay? You know, this is not as easy as it looks. Don't try this at home.
Okay, I won't.
when the Bay Stars do get to 3-0, to three ball counts, 3-0, 3-1, 3-2, they're the best team in the Central League.
Hitting wise.
They're the best, yes. They are the best. Take it, when they get way ahead in the count, when they get into a good hitter's count, nobody is as good as they are. Okay, so this is the other side of the coin. They're looking for the first strike, and when they do happen to, you know, get in that, you know, when they're holding all the cards, you know, just walk them. Because they're killing you. So the Bay Stars offense hasn't done much all season, but they do have a plan. They're making it work. I think they're going places this year.
Yeah, I like them. And one of the other things I liked about what Alex said in his interview was the stress of the player statement. Now, obviously, we've heard him talk about the difference between being a player and being a coach or a manager and having to worry about more things than, you know, the things are bigger than you. It's the game's bigger than you. The player, the team is bigger than you. So there's a lot more to worry about. And to hear him actually verbalize that and, you know, you hear it in his voice. It just kind of came to the forefront for me. You know, you can see if a guy's doing well, that's good. But if there are other guys on the team who are not doing well, you just can't be happy overall. You know, you've got to, you're going to worry about those other guys.
Exactly. Your team could be having a great record and scoring lots of runs, but if somebody's not, you know, if people aren't firing on all cylinders, or if the workplace is not a happy environment, you got things on your plate to deal with.
Right. And I read this article, one of the Japanese persons I follow on Twitter tweeted it out, and there was an article about, of course, I've been calling him Ramikan all year. Rami.
Okay.
Ramirez, you know, we used to call him Rami-chan, and now he's a skipper or manager, and that in Japanese that word is Kantoku, so I'm using those words, merging them together and calling him Rami-kan.
And okay. As you are like to do.
As I like, as I'm prone to do as well. You know, the article talked about him standing with his hands in his pockets and not showing enough frustration when bad things were happening.
Yeah, exactly.
And essentially, I guess the fans were saying that his body language wasn't saying what the fans thought his body language should say.
Yeah.
And I, you know, first of all, I remember Bobby Valentine in the dugout, and I really loved his demeanor in the dugout when his team was not executing or things were not going the way that they had planned. His demeanor, to me, I interpreted it as, okay, well, now we have to figure out how to win this game a different way.
Yeah.
Now we have to take a different approach, or what can we do to win this game? Because we are not losing this game. And I just love that. And I think Alex is in a similar, he's in a similar vein in that he doesn't want to show too much negative. I mean, I've seen him throw his arms in the air and celebrate, and you know, sometimes when there's a hit that's going in the air, obviously going out toward the outfield, he's one of the first guys off the dugout to see if it's going out or not, along with the rest of the bench, you know, all the guys on the play. He's just as excitable in that respect. But when there are negative things going on, he doesn't look down. And I read this article, and you know, he talked about leadership and how he can't allow himself to display doubt. And obviously I'm translating. I'm sure, I don't know if he gave this statement in Spanish. He probably did, and it was translated into Japanese, so now I'm bringing it into English. But the statement in the article said basically, quote, "You can't look down. Only the guys who continue to look ahead get positive results," end quote. So I really like that. I think, look, you know, that's my attitude. If I'm coaching or something, if something bad happens, okay, what do we have to do now to get this game in our hands and win it at the end? And, you know, whatever that is, that's what I'm thinking about. I'm not thinking about the bad things that are happening. Obviously, you want to stop the bad, you know, however you can quell, however you can quell
stop.
It.
Bad stop, good continue.
But then let's get, you know, what do we have to do on the other side so that we can score enough to win the game? And so I really like his demeanor on the bench. And of course, I always try to put myself in these situations. And if I were a manager on the bench, I would try not to get too high and not to get too low, because there's so much emotion. There's so many games. It's such a long season. It's just hard to ride the roller coaster that long.
Says a guy who is constantly riding the roller coaster of all the teams he follows. I want to see that trick. I want to see the new John Gibson. What's the word I'm looking for? Calm and unaffected and passionate.
But still
calm and stable. I want to see that John Gibson instead of the guy who's saying, "Come on, Blue."
I'm a lot better than I used to be. Let's put it that way. It's an ongoing process.
It is indeed, and we're getting there. And I think the day they put the nails on the box, we'll say, "Okay, we got it."
Hashtag high heat.
All right, hey, man. Let's not put me in a box yet.
Let's not. And I guess the last word I want to say about that is that, when I listen to Alex Ramirez, I want to ask, you're going to tell me your plan? Oh, wait, I got another question. Tell me why you do this. Tell me why you do that. Because I'm so used to managers saying, you know, like, mind your own business.
Yeah, they hand you the line.
Or, we do this in Japan. So how about them Bay Stars, John?
Yeah, they're doing well. They're at 30-30 as we were taping on Sunday morning here before the games, the last games of the weekend. So they're at 500. They won, after they got swept, I believe, by the Hawks. And no shame in that.
Yeah, they'll get over it.
They came back and they're gonna go for a sweep today against the Buffaloes. And again, if there's no shame in getting swept by the Hawks, there's nothing to boast about in sweeping the Buffaloes.
Wow.
But they are a PL team, so I've been told. Yeah, so they're supposed to be good. So I'm looking at the fact that they picked up this guy, Alien Herrera, and I'm familiar with him because he's a former Dodger and he also played with the Milwaukee Brewers. And I saw this pickup and I'm thinking, okay, well, here's a switch hitting Nigel Morgan without all the pizzazz. Here's a guy who's not really going to hit for a lot of power, but he can play all over the field.
Yeah.
So whenever
he plays all over the field when he's at third base, this guy, he's a heck of a fielder.
Yeah, he can pick at it. I mean, he was not bad at short. He was not bad at second from what I remember. And, you know, he can play the outfield as well. So I think here's a guy and he's a switch hitter. He's like the Swiss Army knife that Ramirez can use whenever somebody else gets injured or when somebody's slumping. Swiss and he can get him in the lineup and get a lot of at bats. And he's a really useful guy.
Yeah, sounds like if the bottles don't open out of the cooler, like, he can open them too.
Yeah, okay. 99 bottles of beer on the wall. Where's Alien?
Exactly.
We don't have a can opener. We need this guy. But
he can do it for you.
Yeah, Alien was involved in this incident this week in which Jose Lopez, I call him J-Lo, got injured. And at first the reports were that he cracked his toenail on his left foot, and Alien hit a ball in batting practice that ended up hitting J-Lo's foot. And once they x-rayed it, they found that there was a break in the toe. So this is a pretty tough loss for the Bay Stars. But then again, and I don't think J-Lo has been living up to the expectations in terms of the power playing at that stadium. I just thought he would just be very much more productive there. So for me, what is he hitting, about 275? Yeah, he's doing okay in the power categories. He's driving in some runs, but I'm not going to say it's not a big loss. I just think it's a loss they can overcome.
Well, I think it is a loss they can overcome. I would disagree that it's not a big loss, but I think they've got the tools. I think, again, it's not Jose Lopez's lack of production, I think, as much as it's not as, I think he's sort of where I expected him to be. He's playing well. He's not, you know, he's had some great games, but yes, could he be more? Yeah, he's not at the upper level of what we could expect from him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had his struggles here at the start, and he's done well to get his average up to 275 or wherever it is, but he's leading the team in a few categories. Yes, he is productive, and it's going to be a loss, but they're getting some good production right now from some other guys. So, and it's because, in part because, and it was something that I was saying early on, they had some injuries they were dealing with, and Takayuki Kajitani came back, and I had said that, you know, it's hard to judge Alex. He's not dealing with a full set of cards here in terms of the pieces that he expected to have and the production he expected to have. And so one guy comes back and another guy gets lost, unfortunately. But I still think because he played all these guys earlier in the season that they're used to playing, they have expectations. He's a little bit more familiar about what they can do and what to expect when he puts them in against certain matchups. So, you know, maybe they're going to pull out of this thing and be okay in a month when Jose comes back.
Well, it could be. I mean, one of the things he said the day I talked to him, he was telling the press, you know, they said, oh, do you want to go with a set lineup? He said, I don't think we have the pieces to go with a set lineup. I've got one basic lineup for left-handed opposing pitchers and one basic lineup for right-handed opposing pitchers. And Jamie Romack was sort of saying, well, you know, I wish I played every day.
I be a piece?
Yeah. Can I be one of the regular guys, please? And because he's having trouble, he basically got made some serious adjustments on the farm team. And now he's going like, you know, I need to work on these, but wait, okay, I'm in the lineup today. I'm not in the lineup. So I think he's struggling with that, or he expressed that he was having difficulty with that in this part of his process. And so, you know, that's another thing that Alex has to deal with is, you know, what's best for the team is sometimes what's best for this player at this time.
Right.
So, you know, everything's a compromise to some degree, and he's learning that stuff.
Right. And so another thing I noticed about the Bay Stars is basically, offensively, they only have one player in the top 10 in the stats in the Central League, but on the pitching side, they have three pitchers among the elite in the Central League. And they're all starting pitchers, and the only other team like that is the Carp. So I think basically you look at that rotation, and you can say that's one of the elite rotations in the Central League.
Yeah, I think it is, and I think it's such a shock, because generally, I mean, historically, we've looked at the Bay Stars and we've said, at least I've said, well, you know, if their pitching is middle of the league, it's really good,
right?
Because of where they play, but their ERA is the best in the Central League. They walk the fewest. They strike out. And they're next to the Tigers in strikeouts by their pitchers.
Yep.
They're gonna give up home runs. You pitch in Yokohama, you're gonna give up home runs. But they're doing everything they can. Everything they can control, they are controlling. I mean, how good is that?
Yeah.
I mean,
it's awesome.
I mean, it doesn't get better than that. You've gotta really, really like what's going on in Yokohama.
I think so too. And you know, Yasutomo Kubo came back, mm-hmm. and he had to fight to get a spot in the rotation.
I know, and he's been their best pitcher for a couple of years.
Exactly.
And he pitched well early in the season, and Yoshitomo Tsutsugo said an interesting thing the other night, which, you know, I've talked about before, tweeted about Kubo, you know, allowing a run in eight innings and saying, well, the only way I'm going to win with this team is if I don't allow any runs, mm-hmm. you know, and then cross my fingers.
Right.
So, you know, he was channeling Randy Messenger there, and Tsutsugo drove in the run that made him a winning pitcher the other day. And he said, look, Kubo's been pitching well for us all season. And, you know, it felt really good to get a hit that led to his actually getting a win. And, you know, that's a, you know, being a good team player, you know, standing up for your teammates. So, and it was good to hear that. I do like Tsutsugo, pretty much everything about him, the way he talks, the way he plays, the way he goes about his, everything.
And yeah, we remember Alex Ramirez when he was a member of the Oryx Buffaloes coaching staff last year, mm-hmm. the roving coach, and we had him on an interview. He raved about Tsutsugo
being
one of the top players, top hitters in Japan, even though he was with another team. So, all right. So making a seamless transition, we want to talk about interleague play, and you know, slowly. At first, I was raving about the Central League and saying, "Oh, they're hanging tough, they're doing well." And then, slowly but surely, the PL began pulling away. And in fact, I think it was Thursday that, if you looked at the standings in interleague play, because the Giants got off to a 5-0 start, they were in the top half. But the bottom five teams were all Central League teams. It just looked like they were showing some stats, and they had separated the leagues, essentially. This is what this league does, and this is what this league does, because on one side you had mostly Pacific League teams, and then on one side you had mostly Central League teams.
Yeah. This whole bit about the Pacific League's apparent superiority reminds me a lot of the 15, 16 years ago about the juiced ball that NPB teams were using.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like you could see it in the numbers for several years. Every time a team switched to a Mizuno ball, their home runs allowed and hit would jump. You know, and it was becoming obvious, but the public really didn't notice it until 2004 when the Chunichi Dragons said, "Well, the ball's too lively. You know, we're going to switch balls." They did in the middle of the season.
Oh.
Which the Giants said was unfair. You know, you shouldn't be able to do that. They had no power hitters. Anyway, to cut away from that, the public perception then suddenly shifted to the fact that the balls were too lively, and NPB had to start scrambling for excuses. But I think last year, you know, it had been obvious for several years that the Pacific League was beating the daylights out of the Central League in every competition.
Beating the brain.
Yeah.
Beating
the brains out. I mean, it's just dominating, you know, winning the Japan Series virtually every year, leading Interleague virtually every year, having the best Interleague team virtually every year. And then last year we had that situation where the Central League standings were very compacted, and at the end of Interleague play, there was a day when every Central League team was below 500.
Right, yeah.
And I think it hit home to people like, oh, there is a difference. You know, it's been going on in front of our faces for years and years, but I think it finally caught people's imaginations. You know, this isn't just Interleague. The Pacific League just doesn't have a trick to win Interleague.
And right, and you look at the Hawks, and I mean, it's just not fair. I mean,
it isn't.
What can
but
you
that's
say?
Their job. You know, that's their job, is to have a team that's not fair on opponents.
Well, they're doing excellent work.
They are.
And, you know, I'm wondering, can we just handicap SoftBank somehow? Can we just say, you know, you have to use your second team pitchers during the Interleague? And
hey,
even,
that's what they,
of course,
that's,
even that's an unfair advantage.
Would be, yeah.
Do you even remember who they drafted this past October? It was the number one pitching prospect, Junpei Takahashi, and we haven't even seen that kid. And I heard a little bit about him recently, that he's getting close to maybe earning a shot or something on the top team, but we just haven't even heard of this guy. And he's supposed to be the best guy.
I know, we were talking in the office the other day. Okay, Rick Vandenhurk is now on the farm team with fatigue. Of course, opening day starter, as usual this time of the season, Tadashi Setsu is on the farm team because he's no darn good until the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going like, and Kenichi Nakata didn't even get a start until fairly recently.
Right.
We're going like, who the heck is in the Hawks rotation that there's, you know, and it's Kodai Senga, and it's Shota Takeda, of course, and it was Vandenhurk, and it's like, this is like, whoever they've got is good. And, you know, Tsuyoshi Wada, who's had kind of a lousy ERA, but he was winning games.
And remember Hiroki Yamada, the left-hander, the little soft toss?
Yes.
He got a start the other day. I mean, they have guys on the farm who could beat on the teams in the Central League.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I don't even know if that's a handicap.
I know. I mean, in what other team would they be saying, do you remember Daisuke Matsuzaka? You know, he hasn't done anything. You know, they'd be going, we were depending on him. The Hawks, they don't depend on nobody.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, if you don't get it done, see you later, babe.
Yeah, they depend on the system, and the system is to recruit and then develop players who turn out very good.
Their pitching staff, and I'm a Swallows fan, their pitching staff is the opposite of the Swallows. Last year, the Swallows had their, you know, they've developed a good offense, and they still got that.
Right.
But what happened last year was they had enough healthy arms to get them through the second half of the season, and well, that may still happen in the second half of this season, but Shohei Tateyama won't be there. A couple of guys won't be there.
Mm.
And, you know, so I'm thinking this is the huge difference. SoftBank, you know, they just get on the phone and they say, you know, just pick a guy. Just pick one of those guys on the farm team. We can use them.
Right.
Because we know they're good.
The only solace was that I saw about halfway through, and this is obviously changed a little bit now, but after through 9 games, there were 6 players hitting at least 400. And that included Seiya Suzuki of the Carp, which was very impressive,
yep.
And a bunch of other Pacific League guys. But at least they had the guy who was hitting the best was a Central League guy. Now, I don't know if that's the case now.
Mm.
And probably by the end of games today, that might not be the case. But, yeah, you know, at least they had that going for them.
Yeah, it's not been a total annihilation, which is always possible.
Okay, now making a two-seam transition, the other night I was on the way home and I was listening to a game on the radio and I heard the radio announcer, and you'll hear in this tape that Michael Westbay refers to it as a TV announcer, that's not correct, but the radio announcer said he just oversimplified the home run totals for both leagues by saying the Central League has X number and the PL League has X number, therefore the Central League is a more power-hitting team, blah, 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 of top power-hitting league. There are more home runs there. And I'm like, you know, it can't be that simple. And we've talked about it on the show. We know that there are homer-friendly parks in the Central League and pitcher-friendly parks a lot. It's harder to hit some home runs in some of the parks in the Pacific League. We know the pitching is different. It just can't be that simple. So Michael Westbay, our buddy, put this together for us.
Recently, a TV commentator commented that the Central League has more power this season than the Pacific League. John told me that his first reaction to this comment was that it was, quote, simplistic and wrong. But this is similar to what John was saying a week or two ago, that it took the Pacific League a while to get their first home run of the season. As of the end of play on Wednesday, June 8th, the Pacific League has 256 home runs compared to the Central League's 279. That's a pretty significant gap. But, of course, ballparks not being created equal in the two leagues, is there a way to compare the two on an even footing to see if the Central League has overtaken the Pacific League in power hitting? Taking the idea that the two leagues needed to be normalized along lines of their respective stadiums, I first ran the numbers of players against their park effects. Park-adjusted home runs for 2015 strongly favored the Pacific League. Nippon Ham's Brandon Laird and Sho Nakata were on top with 35 and 33 adjusted home runs, respectively, followed by Cebu's Takuya Nakamura with 30 and SoftBank's Yuki Yanagita with 29. Yakult's triple three man, Tetsuo Yamada, ranked 5th, his 38 actual home runs only counting for 27 when adjusted for the tiny Jingu Stadium. Yokohama's Jose Lopez was the only other Central League batter in the top 10 in 2015 with just 21 adjusted home runs. How do adjusted home runs stack up so far this season? Well, the Central League is represented by 6 of the top 10 adjusted home run hitters. Chunichi's Dayan Viciedo and Yakult's Tetsuo Yamada are on top with 17 adjusted home runs each. The Fighters' Brandon Laird is just below with the Lions' Ernest Mejia at 16. Not much difference at the top, but the Pacific League lost number 10-ranked Lee Deho to the MLB, while the Central League heralded the return of Yakult's Vladimir Ballantyne, ranking in at 8th with almost 12 adjusted home runs, and Hiroshima's Brad Eldred climbing from ranked 16th in 2015 to 9th this season, almost even with Ballantyne. Finally, I wanted a way to compare the 2 years with just a single number for each. For that, I averaged the number of adjusted home runs per game for each of the 16 players that made up the top 10 for 2015 and 2016. Summing up the difference from 2015 to 2016 average adjusted home runs per game, I get an increase of a little more than two-thirds home runs per game for the Central League batters, while the Pacific League increased by just a little bit over one-tenth of an adjusted home run per game. Once interleague play is complete, I'd like to revisit this and do a head-to-head comparison over the 2 years. The standard disclaimers for small sample size apply for both park adjustments and the results. But the data does suggest that the Central League has increased its power output significantly more than the Pacific League over last season. Is this just the Pacific League aging? Is it the pitching? Has the ball been changed yet again? I'll leave it to John and Jim to speculate about the possible causes. Back to you two.
Well, thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed that.
And
I think that's accurate. I think it's fairly obvious. I mean, the Central League has three parks where the balls really fly out, and the Pacific League doesn't.
Right.
Now, they've changed. I mean, the Pacific League is a more home run friendly league than it, you know, with the changes at in Sendai,
mm-hmm.
and the changes in Fukuoka have altered that balance.
Right, the what is the home run terrace in Fukuoka, which we will check again at some point.
Right. So that's changed the balance, but, you know, it used to be Sendai was really hard to hit home runs, not like Koshien's hard, but it was hard, and then Fukuoka Dome and Sapporo Dome were on a par with Nagoya Dome and Koshien, so it was, so that's changed, but yes, I think when you look at it, it's fairly obvious that the numbers for the Central League home runs, which are up this year,
mm-hmm.
are numbers that are influenced largely by the parks that they play in.
Right. Right. Okay. A couple things now, in Michael's little segment, he referred to Ernesto as Ernest, which is fine. He's been Ernest in hitting home runs. So,
yes,
I remember when Vin Scully used to call Pedro Guerrero Pete Guerrero all the time. So but he did refer to, Tetsuo Yamada as Tetsuo, and he corrected himself the second time. So no problem. I slip up with names all the time. So we don't need the Tweedians jumping over everything to correct things. We heard it and he knows who he's talking about. So that's no problem.
I guess the one thing I want to add is that I guess the best true case of which team has the most pop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the most pop per pitch, as opposed, you know, regardless of the park, is look how they hit home runs in interleague.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And basically, you know, just give it up, Central League.
Well, my point is the announcers shouldn't be able to poison young baseball minds by being so simplistic with the, and oversimplifying the numbers.
Mm.
I mean, come on, guys, you can do better.
Well, basically, you know, I looked year by year, and the Central League has led the Pacific League in home runs in 2012,
mm-hmm.
in 2009,
mm-hmm.
and then my numbers come from 2006. So the Central League has basically not led except slightly in a couple of years. And in the beginning of interleague play, when the Rock-10 Eagles and the Oryx Buffaloes were giving away so many home runs that there was no way the Pacific League could keep up.
Mm. Okay. All right, making a four-seam transition, I want to talk about the great Ichiro Suzuki, and he is moving quickly toward the 3,000-hit plateau. He's also on the verge of matching or surpassing Pete Rose's number of hits for a player at the professional level, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I guess I'd say top-flight professional hits, because we're not going to include Pete Rose's 100-some hits in the minors or Ichiro's 250 Western League hits. So.
Right. And, of course, this is going to spark debate about Ichiro. Mm. Where do we put him? Where is he going to be? Is he better than Pete Rose? I don't think we're going to compare them that way. But I would like to bring this up. And of course, I've had my issues with Ichiro personally, and he's not one of my favorite players. I'm not... You know, I wasn't impressed. I was impressed with him when he was in Japan. I really liked what he did. Then when he went to the major leagues, he turned into mostly just a slap and run guy. And now he's just, I don't know, this season, I really didn't think, I've had this debate with friends on Facebook mm-hmm. about him reaching 3,000, about him reaching Pete Rose. And when he went to the Miami Marlins, I didn't think he would get enough at bats. And I said, it's going to be difficult and I don't see it happening. And now that he's steaming towards
yeah, I know.
Both, I just have to marvel at him. He just made me look at him in a different light. I have newfound respect for him. It's not that I never disrespected him. It's just that at 42, he's really opening my eyes even wider.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I guess I'll try to be succinct, which is hard when, you know, when you come across a player like Ichiro who's, I guess he demands hyperbola.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's so extreme. Now, I was speaking with a major league scout yesterday, and we were basically agreed in our dislike, our disappointment in the way Ichiro's career went, knowing, you know, here's a guy who has all these wonderful tools,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, focused them on such a narrow band, you know, that he became the hit guy, the singles guy.
Mm-hmm.
The singles and stolen base guy. Okay, so having said that, we always thought he could do much more. But, okay, now here's the other side. Now I'm not going to say I have more respect for him now because of his numbers and his consistency now at the age of 42. But I will say that while I didn't have a lot of respect for the way he applied his skills, you always have to respect the way he developed his skills. And became the player who could do this at 42. Somebody commented on BillJames.com, I think it is, or Bill James Online, excuse me. Somebody commented that StatCast said Ichiro Suzuki at the age of 42 is the fourth fastest major leaguer down the line. He's tied. He's tied with Jose Altuve.
Oh my gosh.
So, okay, so that you got, all you have to say is, yeah, here's to you for that.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's, you know, nothing against him for that, and the ability to be where he is, that we're disappointed that he didn't go in a different direction, draw more walks, and have a broader based approach, is, you know, it's half empty, half full.
Yeah.
He made this wonderful thing and then we're disappointed that he didn't go farther with it. Okay, that's my fault as much as it is his. Now, the other thing is, I want to say is, do I love Ichiro as a player? As a fan, I love Ichiro. And the reason I love Ichiro is because when he's playing, when he's in a game, the dull moments of that game are more or less reserved for when he is on the bench waiting to hit.
Right.
Because when he's in the batter's box, you're thinking, wow, this is coming up. He's like Shohei Ohtani batting, you know. I might see something interesting. When he bats, you got something to watch. When he's on the bases, you've got something to watch. When he's playing right field or center field or whatever field he's in, you've got something worth watching.
Yep.
And that's, to me, from an entertainment view, and I'll liken him to Shohei Ohtani again, because this is a guy, he does something that's so unique and so interesting, it just pulls you into the game.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who don't like, oh, Shohei Ohtani, I heard this from a player the other day, shouldn't be hitting because he'll never be a great hitter, he'll never hit in the major leagues, he should be focusing on becoming the best pitcher in the world. But you know what? As a fan, I'm thinking, no, he should be entertaining me.
Exactly, yeah.
And he's doing it.
Yep.
So go for it, Ichiro, go for it, Shohei, keep doing it.
Now, I'd like to make this argument just because it's fun.
Oh!
Just because it's fun.
Okay, go ahead, so, I'm good for fun.
So we've seen, I know the comparisons are going to start, and we've seen hundreds of players from around the world, obviously, come to Japan and fail miserably. They struggle. Mm-hmm. With a different approach, they struggle with the quality of the control of the pitchers in Japan. Mm. But although Ichiro never hit 400 in a season, and I think it was 2000 that he hit 387, so he came really close. Yeah, he also hit very at a very high level in his prime in the major leagues as well.
Yep.
So, obviously, I think Pete Rose was a great player.
Sure.
But I don't think it's even close when you compare all the tools. You add the defense, the speed, the arm.
As soon as you put defense in it, Pete Rose is backseat.
I think Suzuki could play circles around Pete Rose and make him look silly.
Yeah. Now.
And so if you add all that in and consider that with the different approach, the vastly different approaches here in Japan and in the major leagues, that these hit totals are very comparable. And I know a lot of people are going to say, well, no, you know, it's just Japan. And we've heard that so much. And I say, well, there have been guys who have come over here and couldn't do anything. And then they go back to the major leagues where the patterns are very similar. And that's why they can hit, because they can sit on pitches. So I think the package of Ichiro is a better package than Pete Rose. And I don't think anybody can argue differently.
I think you're correct. I think that won't stop people from arguing just because they don't have a leg to stand on. I think we were discussing this great length in the office because we have to deal with the language. You know, is Ichiro approaching this? Is Ichiro approaching that? Our sports department at Kyoto News was saying he's approaching Pete Rose's record, and I said, no, he's 1,300 hits from Pete Rose's record.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's just get that out of the way. But here's the question now. The problem that Ichiro had was that, not that he was in Japan, but that he was in a league that played 130 games.
Yeah.
Getting 200 hits a season in a 130-game season is something that has happened in Japan three times.
Huh?
Ichiro, three players have had 200 hits in 130 games or less. Ichiro Suzuki, Matt Martin, Shogo Akiyama.
Okay.
It doesn't happen. So, the first part is, okay, so that's in Ichiro's favor vastly. He has about 1.2 hits per game in his career.
Mm.
Pete Rose is like 1.11. Japan's all-time hit leader, Isao Harimoto, is about 1.108.
Wow.
So he's so far ahead of these guys. Now, to Pete Rose's credit, he was playing in an era. He began his career, I believe, in the major leagues in 1961 or 62, it was the start of a dead ball era. For 8 years, you know, major league batting averages plummeted for reasons, it's a long story, but it was really hard to get hits. So you have to give him credit for getting hits when nobody got them.
Right.
So, as a guy up there getting singles, you know, you give one credit for one, the other for the other, but to say that they're not they're very comparable in terms of offense. And then as soon as you add in defense, it's like base running. Okay. Game's over. Game story's over. Yeah. How many golden gloves did, Pete Rose win? Wait, okay.
Yeah, it's no comparison.
And the other thing with Pete Rose, and I hate to tear him down because again, he was a great player, but in his pursuit to chase Ty Cobb, he was the manager of the Cincinnati Reds, putting himself in the lineup at first base when they had Wayne Krenchecki, who was a vastly better player at that point in his career, at that point in their careers. He was sitting the best player so that he could pursue a hit total.
Okay.
To me, those hits shouldn't count.
Yeah.
Because that's not what you... I mean, because the hits matter because they're in games that are supposed to be contests about helping your team win. Gotcha. When you forfeit that goal, the hits themselves cease to be important, which is the difference between, you know, baseball and professional wrestling. So,
okay.
Pete Rose's end of his career was pro wrestling.
Oh my. And with that, we'll go to the notes. Now, Shohei Ohtani, and I emailed you earlier in the week, and I said, how many of these two-way players have we seen have had a season where they've had a 17-game hitting streak and also hit five home runs in consecutive games?
Yeah.
And fired the fastest pitch in the – well, I guess at that time, even at that time, so if it would have been 155 kilometers
Never
at
happened.
That time – how many guys have done that in one season? And the answer is, I'm sure, none.
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say it's never happened.
But yeah,
now,
yeah.
And I asked John. I asked John, which two-way players are you talking about? Well, I did a little search, which you'll see when I finish the study.
Okay.
On my website, but I basically was looking at how many guys pitched in eight games, played in eight games, actually played in positions other than pitcher in eight games in a season, and had more than five at bat, had at least five at bats per pitching appearance.
Okay.
So we can get guys who were actually hitting and pitching. And the answer is basically, since 1954, Shohei Ohtani's the only one. Now, before 1954, we had guys doing it here and there. Okay. But, and then if you look at guys who did it more than 1 year, there's basically about seven guys. Most of them are pretty borderline. They're basically, with a few exceptions, they're borderline pitchers or borderline fielders. They're borderline hitters or borderline fielders. Although a couple of them are in the Hall of Fame for either being pitchers or hitters.
All right. What we're watching from Shohei Ohtani is historic stuff, and it's really fun. I can't wait to see him bat the next game. All right. And then the one other note I had was, Rakuten Eagles rookie Louis Okoye this past week, experienced his first career podium, post-game interview on the field. And then later he tripled on a double. And then yesterday he doubled on a single. This guy is going to be really exciting. He had a three-hit game on Saturday, and that was his first one of his career. He's really going to be exciting. Hopefully he'll be able to add a little bit of power to that game, and I think he's going to be a perennial all-star in a few years.
Yep. Scott, I talked to you yesterday, said, wow, what a player. What an athlete. So that's going to be fun. NPB Reddit pointed out a story in which the Eagles on May 29th started four rookies.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
Right. And so that's the first time that had happened in nearly 50 years.
Yeah, I remember 50. I remember the half-century mark being
there. I saw that, and I'm thinking, okay, here's Mr. Nishida, the guy who basically took a step backwards with every team he's managed for the first year and won a pennant in the second year. So I'm thinking, these guys, watch out for these guys next year, because obviously Louis Okoye has made a lot of adjustments on the farm team. He's now making them on the first team. He seems certainly like the guy we said knows what to do with a bat in his hand.
Yep. All right, let's go to fielding questions. All right, the first one comes from Jet Boy Max, and he asks, what's the chance a team like the Dodgers signed Tetsuto Yamada to play second base if he's posted in 2017? Do you like the idea? Hashtag high heat.
Let's ask the guy who let's ask the guy we can give a quarter to, and he actually gives a darn about who the Dodgers signed.
All right, let's ask Jim that question then.
Hashtag high heat.
My answer is absolutely not. The Dodgers should have no business signing Tetsuto Yamada.
All right.
Because I want him to play second base for the San Francisco
Giants. So
they can move Joe Panik to third.
Or they can move Joe Panik to another team. I did, as far as I could see, the Dodgers have two prospects, high grade prospects at second base in their system. A guy named Willie Calhoun and another guy named Micah Johnson. And Calhoun's 21, Johnson's 25. So, again, we've talked to guys, if you're a prospect and you haven't made it to the major league level at 25, soon the prospect tag gets taken off. So
yeah, pretty much. Yeah, we might see Micah Johnson in Japan in a few years.
Yeah, so, if the Dodgers are indeed interested in Tetsuto, it would still be a tough sell to ownership to me to bring in a guy who's a middle infielder like that, who's kind of thin, kind of small. We had the Tsuyoshi Nishioka experience in the majors with the Twins. He got injured trying to turn a double play. Kazuo Matsui, Tadahito Iguchi were the last two guys I remember who played really well at the middle infield position. So I don't think it's a position that's good for Japanese given the history. But do I think they should? Yes. And they need somebody. I think they're going to be looking for somebody to team with Corey Seager if Corey Seager stays at at shortstop, where they've had him. But he's such a big kid that I've heard that they're thinking about moving him to third base eventually. So do I think they should? Yeah, I just don't know. I just, you know, I'm torn, to be honest. You say yes, bring him in. I think he changes as a hitter completely if he goes to the major league. So the expectations have to be reevaluated, in my opinion.
Well, I think, yeah. Well, I'll say what I said before. The sooner he goes, the better.
Right.
We have disagreements about, you know, whether the park should impact your decision. My answer is no. He's going to be a valuable, he'd be a valuable player if he played in a park that, if he played for the Tampa Bay Rays, he'd be a valuable player. Yeah. He'd be wonderful. It would impact his numbers, but I don't think it would impact the kind of value he has as a player.
I'm just interested when he does go to see the fine citizens of the United States butcher his name, Tetsuto. I don't think many people are going to be able to say it, and they'll probably give him a nickname that's easier to pronounce right away.
Be calling him testosterone. Probably.
Oh gosh. One note I saw on TV last night is that he had hit home run number 20 on Saturday, and that's game 65 mm-hmm. for the Swallows. And last year he hit home run number 20 on July 21st, game 85. So he's way ahead of that pace. So he's getting better, people. You hear that, Dodgers?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing because, you know, 2 years ago when he had his breakthrough season, I said we can't expect a lot more. Usually when guys make the adjustment to playing at the top level, then you see slight improvements. And then he made a huge step forward, and he's making a bigger adjustment. He's making more adjustments this year than I thought were possible.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's moving up. All right, another question from Coaster Freak. Mm-hmm. He says, Hayato Sakamoto is having a ridiculous start, meaning great, for us oldies. Could MLB teams be interested in him when he's an international free agent? I noticed he's close to that ninth year of service time and the Giants don't post players. Hashtag high heat. So he reaches free agency this year, as far as my source says. I think he's got 50 more days, so... Mm. I talked to a number of scouts through the years about Sakamoto, and they love him.
Yep.
He's athletic. He's got the power. He's got range. He's got this a good arm. But I also often hear that he doesn't look like he could stand up to the 162-game schedule at shortstop. And, you know, I hear some negatives, too. You look at the numbers, sabermetrics-wise, and I don't think it's easy to figure out what he's going to be in the United States in the major leagues as a player. Mm. I think it's going to be hard to figure out how to translate. I mean, he had the one year where he had, I think it was 2010, he had 31 homers, and it looked like he was going to be a great number three hitter in Japan. And then he has really
Then they changed the ball.
They changed the ball. But even then, since then, he really hasn't been a big-time home run hitter, although he has 12 right now, so he could probably finish in the 20s. You would project him to finish in the 20s, in the high 20s again this year, and that would be his highest total since that 2010 season. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what he is, what he translates to.
He needs to, you know, he needs to learn to generate more bat speed, which means he needs to learn to cheat on fastballs, which you can't really do in Japan.
But he would be able to do in the States.
Cause... I think he would be able to do. I think his power, he'd be able to keep it. He'd lose his average. He'd lose his average. The question is, can he play shortstop, which is a young man's game, and make the adjustments? His play in Japan on artificial turf has become really, really good. Okay, he's approaching the end of his 20s, and he's become a shortstop who can play really, really well on artificial turf. You know, and as you approach that age, you're losing your speed. You know, you're losing that extra oomph. He doesn't have the greatest arm in the world. It's good enough. It's good enough to play in the majors if he was 24.
Yeah.
And so I see him as a player who's good enough, but, and he's good enough, but, and he's good enough, but. So he's almost there, but I don't see, you know, I think if you put, you know, if you put him up for bid, I think he's the kind of guy who, we'll put a few hundred thousand on him and see if, you know, he can tune it up in a level.
You mean in the free agency market?
Yeah, you know, we'll give him a look-see. You know, we'll give him a tryout. and see what, you know, see if he looks like a guy who can make more adjustments. So it has, you know, he has the willpower and the drive to, you know, to turn it on.
Right. But, I think,
but I don't see it. I don't see it. Tetsuo Yamada, I'd give him the keys to the city and say, blow it. You know, this job's yours to lose because we think you can do it.
And I think it's that 4-year gap. I mean, with Sakamoto being 27 and Yamada being 23, I think if we were talking about a 23-year-old Sakamoto, I think a lot of teams would be all over him. But at 27, I don't think they think that they're going to get a guy they can keep for 5 years.
Well, and that's also a difference because 23 Sakamoto is a vastly better player than the 23-year-old Yamada is a historically great player in Japan.
Right.
And Sakamoto was a really good player in Japan. That's the difference. You know, we're talking about somebody who's Yamada as a player who's in the top 1% of seasons, and Sakamoto's been, you know, in the top 10.
All right. Thank you very much for the questions. We appreciate them. And we'll have another one. We have another one held over till next week, so we'll have that one. But if you want to send us a question by email, send it to ykyujohn@gmail.com. Tweet us at #HighHeat. Don't forget the #HighHeat mark at JBW Podcast, or you can go to our Facebook page and leave us a comment there. Look for us on iTunes. Thank you very much for listening, and we will talk to you next week. Enjoy your baseball.
See ya.